reclaiming the past.
The capacity here. Let's pray together, please. Our loving Father, thank you for the time, for the opportunity to spend some time over what we hope would be some credible and some very applicable material. We pray you challenge us this morning, our lives, our hurts, and thinking about those we know who hurt. Help us this morning, we pray, in the name of Christ. Amen. My name is Michael Palmer, and I'm from Oklahoma City. I work for a counseling center down there. And what I'd like to do is talk on the issue of the area of healing for damaged emotions. Some people use the jargon of dealing with painful memories, or reclaiming the past, those sorts of things. Please feel free in the process to jump in and ask any questions. If you have some things to volunteer, feel free. I don't think anybody should aspire to think that they've got all the answers and they've got it locked up. I'm sure there are things that we could learn from you. So please, any questions or things you'd like to add, please feel free to do that. I am particularly intrigued by the subject of dealing with the past, just because we are such powerful social creatures that we carry an incredible wealth of baggage with us from the past. There are things that stay with us, even though we live presently. The past is very much the makeup of the present. It's kind of funny. A few minutes ago, I went for a walk down one of the main streets here in Hartford. This is my first time here. But I grew up in Southern Africa, in Rhodesia and South Africa. But I grew up on a healthy diet maybe not healthy, but a steady diet of people like Neil Diamond and Brooklyn Rhodes. And coming up into this part of the country and seeing places, hearing names that were familiar to me growing up as a child in Southern Africa. In South Africa at the time, we didn't have television, but we did when I lived in Rhodesia, and we would see television things like the Beverly Hillbillies and Bonanza, and there were all these ideas in my mind about the United States of America, and I can't tell you the pleasure to be in this country, but back then the dreams, the anticipations, all these names, New York City. We in flying into this place yesterday, we flew and the visibility was good enough to pick out the New York skyline and the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty barely, and just to see this place, the Central Park. I remember doing a project in Central Park, doing a project on Abraham Lincoln. You guys have no idea how well researched you are across the world, but to think back, just walking down these streets and seeing some of these pictures I'd seen as a child, these streets seem so indicative of pictures I grew up seeing as I read about the United States, films I'd seen in the United States. And there was almost this gush of feelings, and it was a very odd, almost a nostalgic, vicarious thing, because I could translate myself almost to what it was like living in the small town of Kitwe in Rhodesia, and the feelings that I felt and some of the thoughts I had about ever being in this country. But there was almost this sense of going right back, as soon as I saw certain sights, certain things that reminded me. Because memory is that powerful. I mentioned Neil Diamond. I can still hear a Diamond song, and I'm kicked right back to the depression I felt when I was 16 years old in high school. Memories are really, really powerful. And I think that is particularly true and pungent for somebody who has been deeply, severely wounded in the past. Not necessarily in a childhood bracket. As adults, it could happen just a few years ago as an adult, obviously. And the subject really intrigues me. A number of years ago, there was a woman who came to speak at the University of Oklahoma as a guest lecturer. Are any of you familiar with Dr. Jane Goodall, the woman who spent about 10 years living with the primates in the Serengetis in Central Africa? Well, Dr. Goodall came to Oklahoma, and she spoke at the university there, and it was very interesting. She gave this long dissertation on her studies, her research, some of her findings, and there was a forum afterwards where there was some discussion, question and answer. And one student asked her, said, "Dr. Goodall, now that you've done all this, you've spent these 10 years living with these animals, studying, researching, hands-on stuff, good research. Now where to? Where do you go from now?" And her answer was utterly classic. She looked at the young student and she said, "Having done all that, having spent all that much time," she said, "now I know the right questions to ask." See, that is the mark of a good scholar, a good student. Is that having been there, she didn't assume, you're looking at the expert now, she assumed that now I've done enough to begin to ask the right questions. And for having been a believer now for a number of years, I feel that I'm just beginning to broach areas where I'm knowing the right questions to ask. One of them for me is, why is it that as believers, I mean, we hear the jargon. It's very interesting to move through the hall down here, in the coffee hall. You hear all this, the Christian rhetoric. And it's good, obviously. But it's very easy to move into a phase, to slip into the ease of glibly shooting the stuff off our mouths. And we say, be filled with the Spirit. And that sounds very noble. And yet, there are a lot of folks who live with semi-defeated lives, a great deal, on and off. Why is it that we can't make the hurdle? We get halfway up, we scramble over, but there's no clean jumps, or not enough clean jumps to make a sense, a feeling of, I'm really filled with the Spirit and living this victorious life that I hear some of these hot dogs who get up in front of big church groups talk about. You know? Why? Why am I still nagged by so many things, plagued by so many things? And that's where the curiosity comes in. See, for me, Goodall applies there. Now, I feel like that's one of the most appropriate questions to ask, is because it's very easy to glibly talk about Christian experiences, to throw the rhetoric around, to even be polished enough to get the way some of these men have, like Charles Riggs last night. And then you can spiel the stuff out. But why is it that together with that truth, basic, utterly truthful, utterly reliable material, why is it that in conjunction with that, on the day-to-day experience, we are still plagued so much? Why the lack of success, or only partial success? And that's what intrigues me. Part of the answer, I think, lies in this area of the fact that there are damaged emotions, damaged experiences that lie in feelings and memories. Our concepts and our feelings have really been damaged. There is a word that if you have your scriptures, in Hebrews chapter 4, in verses 14 through 16, we'll get to that in a minute, but there is a reference to Jesus identifying with our infirmities, or depending on your translation, that Jesus identifies with, understands our weaknesses. And somehow, in between the brackets of, on one hand, having a problem with sins, and on the other hand, having a problem with sicknesses, there's a middle bracket in between that sort of lies in a gray zone of this area of weaknesses, of infirmities. And they're not moral issues in the sense of if you struggle with them, you're doing immoral things. I'm really wrong, I'm really sinning because I have these weaknesses. That's not what the scriptures talk about. There are a few references in regard to the area of weaknesses or infirmities, and they're not talked about in the context of you sinning. They're talked about in terms of Jesus understanding our weaknesses and our infirmities. There's a gray zone where we battle and we struggle, that it isn't an issue of confession or needing to be filled with the Holy Spirit. You may well be, but still be plagued severely by some things from the past. One way of looking at that is to look at the illustration from nature. Take a cross-section of a tree, and you know that a tree has a series of rings. And any naturalist, conservationist could say, if they knew what they were looking for, they could study each of those rings and they could tell you the history of that tree. And as you look carefully, you can see, well, on this ring, that year, there was a severe drought. This ring, there was a fire that almost destroyed this tree. This ring, just a glut of rain. This ring, and somehow, in a similar fashion, underneath our own bark, our own exterior, there are a series of rings of experiences that if you could peel back some of the bark, and I guess that's where a lot of our masks and our hidings and our strategies come into play. They protect us so very well. And not too many people know about those inner rings, but we've got them. And they take form in the shape of our feelings and our concepts, our feelings and our memories. What lies there? And the few times that you feel I can share on a more intimate level about what I really feel about certain things, what I really think about certain things, what is really the content when you get down to the grassroots there? And in that bracket, that's where you see a lot of the hurts, a lot of the wounds. There's one exceptional book that I would recommend highly by David Siemens, and it's on the list there, Healing for Damaged Emotions. Let me begin, first of all, by an illustration from Scripture. How many of you are relatively familiar with the life of Joseph? Let me scan just a few highlights of Joseph's life in Genesis, the book of Genesis. His life runs from, for the most part, Genesis 37 through Genesis 50. I'm not going to read the whole section there, but just some highlights. Just for the sake of some background, Joseph, as many of you may know, but just if some aren't that aware of him, where he fits in biblical history. And I've got to tell you, Joseph illustrates this thing of wounds and dealing with some wounds very, very well. you know, the founding father was, I mean, after you've dealt with Adam, you get down to Abraham. Abraham had some children. Notably, who? Isaac. Ishmael was the other one notable, and he became the father of the Arabic nations, right? Isaac, out of which came, he was the progenitor of the Jewish nation. Isaac had children. Who were Isaac's children?
Jacob.
Right, Jacob and Esau, right. Jacob then had a number of children. You know who they are? Right. Yes. Actually, 13 children. Dinah, with one daughter, and then 12 sons who became the 12 tribal heads of Israel. And so when you hear about the Levites, the Simeonites, the tribe of Judah, it began with those 12 sons of Jacob. Joseph is one of those 12 sons. And this picks up on some specifics about Joseph. He was, if I remember correctly, he was next to the last son. By this time, his father was quite old. And so what you ended up with is a grandfatherly type of approach to parenting, which is not wise, because he doesn't really deal with his son like a father-son and the discipline and the parenting. It's more like a doting grandfather, as is indicated in this outset here. In verse 1 of chapter 37, it says, "Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan." That's the father. "These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age..." Now, the things I highlight, try and just put them on the shelf and just hold them for a while. 17 years of age, pasturing the flock with his brothers while still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, Zilpah, his father's other wives. "And Joseph brought back a bad report about the brothers to their father." Now Israel, which was another name for Jacob, loved Joseph, look at this, "more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age." There's that grandfatherly thing beginning to come through. "And he made him a multicolored tunic." So you've got a child who is 17, and he's next to the youngest. Benjamin was still to come. He was going to be the youngest. And he was made the object of his father's doting attention. The upshot was that he gives him a gift, and there's no mention of giving the other brothers a gift of this multicolored cloak. In verse 4, "His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not even speak to him on friendly terms." So you've got some wonderful family experiences taking place there, right? Think of the dynamics. Well, one of the hard things about reading something like this from the text is it can appear so cold. And you have to try and use your creative imagination a little bit. What would it have been like? What does it mean when he says, "they hated him"? Now, it's easy to shoot from that verse to the next verse. But when you've got 10 other brothers, you're not sure what Benjamin's going to feel about Joseph yet, but you've got 10 who say, "Joseph, frankly, we hate you." You know that day to day, things are not very fun for Joseph growing up at home there. And he's also very gifted, and he has the gift of prophecy, consistent with Old Testament life. And there's this dream about the sheaves bowing down to the one. He interprets the dream saying, "You guys are all going to bow down to me," which obviously impressed his brothers, right? So after that, in verse 11, after stating that, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept that saying in mind. The upshot toward in the latter part, verse 18 on, in chapter 37, there is the record of the brothers being quite a ways away near a place called Dothan, and they were with the flocks and so on, and Joseph was sent with food and provisions for the other brothers. When they see him coming, as in verse 18, you can just scan, they say, "Here comes the kid, let's do him in." Reuben, the oldest, is the only one to have some sense, and he says, "Let's not kill him, please." Apparently the pattern at this time for slave trade was they would leave these deep pits that if you're thrown in without a ladder, there's no way to get out. And what they ended up saying was, they wanted to kill him. Reuben convinces them not to. They end up throwing him in. Reuben had planned to go back later and get him out. Before he did that, though, a group of Midianite slave traders came by. They found this little kid in a hole, jerked him out, and took him off. Then skip over to chapter 39. Verse 1, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, and the Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him down from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. Now his master saw the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all he did to prosper in his hand." That is a curious phrase. His master, which was Potiphar, who bought Joseph, saw that the Lord was with him. Then look down a little further, because you realize, by the way, he's moved now from being a favorite son as a young Jewish child to being a slave in a foreign culture with a foreign language and a foreign religion. Think about that. For me to come from South Africa to this country was not a major cultural shock. There were some subtleties to that, but not real. compared to, say, if I only spoke, say, Zulu, and came here, and this was, and I'd never seen films and never knew what it was like to live in the United States, then we're talking culture shock. You have to learn how to speak your language and learn your idioms and your metaphors and those sorts of things. And the subtleties of culture can kill you. And he has this radical shift from Jewish, Hebrew kind of situation to a foreign situation, favorite son to a slave. The bottom rung of the ladder, utterly. However, even in that situation, despite what the brothers did to him, okay, betrayal, kidnapping, despite what they did to him, the upshot is still that the Lord was with him, which is a very important curiosity, because it seems to us, in our logic, that if things go wrong, God is obviously doing me in, or he has left me, or where is God in this whole thing? And it's very feasible that in the social context, as we rub shoulders with each other, as responsible free agents, that I can make choices that radically affect your life. If I became a politician in this country, I can make choices that could destroy your life. You may not see it up close and personal, but from up in Washington, if I was up there, I can make choices that radically affect your life. The social experience is extremely powerful in family, or by extension, in a political situation, that we deeply affect each other's lives very, very much. And yet, even though I may be affected negatively by you hurting me or you enacting a legislative process that hurts my life, affects my life, the Lord is still true to himself. And we are responsible to make choices, but God doesn't necessarily superimpose his control factor, his intervening power in every situation to say, oh no, don't touch Mary. Mary never gets harmed. She never gets wrestled. Or don't touch Frank. God doesn't work that way. He works in a social system. There's room in there for miracles, and God is obviously sovereign to the hilt. But there's a social experience where we rub shoulders and we affect each other's lives, intimately and by extension in some situations. And yet, even where I'm hurt, God is still with me in that, as is indicative in Joseph's situation here. You know the rest of this chapter fairly well, where Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. In verse 7, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused, saying to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and has put me in charge of all that he owns. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil and so sin against God? I think is a terrific mindset, that even in deep hurt and being shot down, he's still able to say, I know God is with me in this, and I'm still going to honor God even though I'm in a bad situation. The follow-up to this was, you know, that she tried to seduce him. He didn't go for it. And she ended up, remember that she grabbed the cloak, held the cloak, and then she just set him up. She framed him. And when Potiphar comes home, who's he going to believe? This Jewish kid or his wife? So what happens? To the big house, right? So he goes to jail. And then the next chapter, the latter part of that chapter, before that, in verse 19, came back when his master heard the words of his wife, this is what the slave did to me, and so on, goes to jail in verse 20. In verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph. See, even in prison, it's very crucial, was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. And it's curious that even though as a hurt, fragile person, Joseph still, by appropriating God's resources, he becomes the best slave that he could possibly be. Then when he gets kicked down a rung lower on the ladder to prison, he becomes the best convict he could possibly be. And he's given charge over part of his whole household. Then he's given charge over the whole prison. Now, the jailer just says, run the prison. In verse 23, the jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord is with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper. Then in chapter 40, you begin to think, would somebody please give this kid a break? Right? And there are two fellows, the cupbearer and the baker, who were in the household of Pharaoh. He had offended the king of Egypt, and Pharaoh has them both put in prison. They both have a dream. Joseph interprets the dream, and he says to one, you are going to not make it out of prison. They will execute you. To the other, he said, you will go back. I think it was the cupbearer who got out alive. And he said, you'll go back to Pharaoh. But look at verse 14. It's not just that Joseph was so spiritual and that he had it all together. You're talking about a real live human being, flesh and blood. And try and look behind the words here. He says, you're going to go back to Pharaoh. You're going to go back and serve him. You'll have direct access to the leader of the land. In verse 14, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you. And please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. See, think of how pregnant that is. when you get out of here and when things are going well with you, please do me a favor. Remember me. Get me out of this place. See if Pharaoh can get me some kind of pardon to get out. And you know, the idea of giving the kid a break, it doesn't happen. Because in chapter 41 and verse 2, it says it happened at the end of 2 full years. So this guy gets out and things go well with him for 2 years, and he doesn't remember this Jewish kid at all. And then next occurrence recorded was that Pharaoh had a dream that none of his diviners, none of his mystics could interpret. And that's when this guy says, ah, there's this Jew boy, little Jewish fellow. Would you consider talking to him? And this Hebrew youngster comes up, and he's able to interpret. And that was the dream regarding 7 very lean famine years, and you need to have some very good economic planning, food preservation, and so on. For the 7 years following, I'm sorry, there'll be 7 fat years, then 7 lean years. So preserve, conserve, plan, store. Based on that, the Pharaoh then says, we're dealing with a fairly sharp young man here. And he pulls him out, he gets him out of prison, and he's elevated to the position of Prime Minister of Egypt eventually. And he's put in charge, one of his duties is this food storage plan. Subsequent to that, though, in chapter 45, when the famine years hit, and Egypt has got all the storehouse stuff, and the food begins to dry up, resources in all the surrounding areas, where do they go? To the place that's got it. They go to the oasis, and Joseph's the man. One of the groups that had food dry up on them were the Israelites. And so Jacob's sons come to talk to this individual, and they have no idea that this is their brother, who's now the Prime Minister of Egypt. And they come to ask for food to take back to their area of the land. There's been some discussion and some meeting between them already. They don't know who he is. They haven't recognized him. Years have passed. There were approximately 13 years that had lapsed here of time in slavery and time in prison. And we're talking about damaged emotions and painful memories. Plenty of platform to create that in that experience. And then here he is as a much more mature, older man who has probably incorporated a great deal of Egyptian culture in his life, how he dresses, how he carries himself, and so on. They don't recognize him. But in verse 1 of chapter 45, it says, Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried, have everyone get out from me. So there's no one with him when Joseph finally made himself known to his brothers. And in verse 2, look, think of how powerful and how fragile things like feelings and memories are. Because when he finally does that, these are my brothers. In verse 2 he says, so he wept so loudly that even though he sent everyone out, the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Whatever the makeup or the plan was of the palace system, however far they were, him breaking down emotionally, his voice and his weeping still carried a great ways apparently. And then in verse 3, Joseph says, I am Joseph. And what's his first question? His dad's still alive. Isn't that interesting? What would that be like to be shuttled on a moment's notice out of your safe little nest at 17 years of age, and kicked into a new system by betrayal and kidnapping into slavery and prison and have approximately 13 years of your life lapse. And you've got to wonder, what has happened to my father? His dad's still living. Seeing his brother stand before him, well, what kind of emotional jerk would that have done on his emotions? But look at his attitude, though. In verse 3, Joseph says to his brothers, I am Joseph, his dad's still alive. But his brothers could not answer him. They were dismayed. They were in awe. This is incredible. Could this really be Joseph? Then in verse 4, he says, come closer to me. They come close, and he says, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. But look at verse 5. And now, because they must have, you know, in those days, you know, when the king said, it's the end for this guy, he's out. I mean, you're talking about termination. Those guys had absolute rule. Lordship to us is a tough concept because we think democratically. Lordship to these people, they understood what a king was. So when we say King Jesus, often our semantics are real limited. They understood semantics, the semantics of king and lord back then. And these guys knew this fellow could do us in, as gets borne out even more so in a few chapters. But at this point, he may well, in their awe and their fear possibly, have picked up on that, and his response to them in verse 5 is quite staggering. He says, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. And then he qualifies that by saying, because God sent me before you in order to preserve life. So that even in deep, powerful pain, there is purpose. because there is a sovereign God. So no matter what happens to me, even the most bizarre, and I can tell you, having counseled at the center for 6 or more years now, I have to struggle a lot with cynicism because I see the dark side of life a lot. Day in and day out, hearing a lot of severe kinds of situations. And it's easy to become cynical and to become jaded that all of life is just like that. I know that's not true, but what is true is that at least part of life is like that. It is jaded and dark, and there are some very bad, tragic things we do to one another or that are done to us. And for me, this is an extremely powerful statement that despite having those experiences, Joseph, when you go back to the time when he's in prison and in slavery, and it says, and the Lord was with him, and apparently he knew it. He was able by that time to incorporate that fact in his life. And when he goes to prison, it says the Lord was with him even in prison, and he was able to incorporate that. To the extent that when he finally sees the offenders, the people who did this to him, who did him in, he can say, somehow, I don't understand the mechanics of this, but there is a God who is greater than what you guys did to me. And he says, beyond that, I forgive you. Which is, you're talking about supernatural stuff there, when people have really seriously hurt you. Now, what's almost humorous, the last chapter of the book, in chapter 50, the Pharaoh, when he learned of the reuniting of the family, he ends up saying to Joseph, listen, bring them in and give them the choicest land they want. So they come in to Egyptian territory and they get the choicest area. But Jacob always said, he said, but when I die, I don't want to be buried on Egyptian soil. Take me back home to bury me. When Jacob dies, which occurs here in chapter 50, the brothers apparently had thought, one mainstay, one buffer against the prime minister of Egypt doing a sin was the fact that Dad was still alive. And maybe it would really bug Dad, and Joseph would know it, if Joseph hammered us before Dad died. And it seems that that was sort of a psychological defense they had, that we'll be fine while Dad's alive. When Dad dies, the guys get a little bit nervous. So in verse 12, thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. They carried him to the land of Canaan, etc., etc. Verse 14, after burying their father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers. But then, look at verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph should bear a grudge and pay us back for all the wrong we did? So they've still carried that guilt, that fear. What if something's still going to come down the pike at us for having done that? And I think they call this eisegesis when you read into the passage. My private guess is that this was not a real message, that this was a contrived message by the brothers. It fits with the logic of what's happening here. They send a message to Joseph, and they say it's a message from Jacob, who has just passed away. Personally, I don't think it was from Jacob. I think the boys contrived this message. They sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged, and I don't think it was the charge of your father. I think that this was the contrived part. Look at the wording. Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgressions of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. That is a godly, sensitive man. It's almost like, listen, Joseph, Dad said, please don't hurt us now that he's gone. Don't hurt the boys, right? And his response, he knows what they're doing apparently, and he weeps. And in verse 18, they come, and they know they're at his mercy. They fall down before him. Behold, we are your servants. Now, look at Joseph's response. Do not be afraid, because I am in God's place. And as for you, I know you guys. You meant evil against me. You meant it. You intended it. But God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. And then on top of that he says, so don't be afraid, do not be scared of me. I will provide for you and for your little ones. And so he comforted them and he spoke kindly to them. See, most of us, and I wonder, in those kinds of severe situations, I wonder, sometimes I try to imagine, how would I handle it? My leaning, knowing my nature, is that I would probably be a little more bizarre than Joseph was. But this kind of attitude is really supernatural. For a person who has been that severely wounded, and I guess, you have to be a little bit imaginative when you read something like the deal on Joseph, to read into what would it be like to have been a doted over, favorite, grandson type of person, coddled, nursed, etc., etc., and then You're the one who gets the gifts. The others all hate you, the jealousy. And the dad's not helping the situation. He's even infusing some of the jealousy by his actions. And then the thoughts. We hate this kid. We're jealous of him, and we want him out of the way. And you've got to imagine the level of hate when they say, we're going to kill him. Take our brother's life. That's pretty far down the road, you know, in terms of hate level. And then what they do, to betray him, to kidnap him, the slavery situation, and the idea that you think somebody would give this little young Jewish fella a break, slavery. But his attitude is, I'm not going to respond, and we'll get this in a few minutes. The issue primarily is it's not so much what happened to me. That is very powerful. But my emphasis, when I stand today and look at what I've been through, what it has been given to me to handle, to deal with, my emphasis I cannot afford to make the emphasis on what happened to me. Obviously, you've got to be intelligent and realistic and say, I know what happened to me. But your emphasis cannot be that. The emphasis has got to be on how am I responding to what happened to me. That is crucial, because apparently Joseph understood that. Because he never did camp on, look what they did to me. Wait until I get my chance. Those guys will pay heavy dues when I get them. That's the seedbed for things like severe, severe bitterness, etc. And then the prison experience, and the betrayal by the friend then, who doesn't remember him. 2 more years, unnecessarily, probably, to have been in prison. For 2 more years of his life, of a young man's life. That's a lot of time to just have blocked out of your life. And you think, here's a guy with damaged emotions, painful memories, you know. Why doesn't he crash? I think that there's some resources biblically to prevent crashing. It's not explained in real detail why Joseph didn't crash, but you get at least a feel for the fact that with the inclusion of God into the experience, I don't have to just sit as a victim of what I was put through. Right, so. Let me skip something. I may come back to it on the life. Because I wanted to show you a biblical example and then a practical example on the life of Ernest Hemingway. Let me make just a brief statement on Hemingway, just to show you a more contemporary type of situation. Because Hemingway, most of us, if you're familiar with his writings, you would say, well, he was given a raw deal. Before I say that. Hemingway, you say, he did some raunchy things. Some of his later books and so on, his lifestyle, most of us know Hemingway for what he was later in life, that he was this globe-trotting, debauched, drinking, somewhat immoral man who developed something of a fetish for killing animals, who on one sunny Sunday morning in Idaho put a shotgun to his head while having been in an outpatient clinic, dealing with depression at the Mayo Clinic, put a shotgun to his head and blew himself away. And we think, that's Ernest Hemingway. And so easy and so glibly said, that person's this way, that person is... And how quickly we assess each other. You know, well, isn't she Miss Prim and Proper? Or what a mouth. You know, what an obnoxious person. And we so quickly relegate people into categories and labels. And there's no appreciation for the rich legacy, the rich background that's there that produced this person. Because Hemingway's background was staggering. Very briefly, he had an evangelical background. Both sets of grandparents were solid believers. One set, very solid. They went to Wheaton College. The grandfather went to... after Wheaton, he became the general secretary of the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA in Chicago, which at that time was literally a Young Men's Christian Association. Was a close personal friend of Dwight L. Moody till Moody's death. There was a solid background. Hemingway, both of his parents were Christians. Dad was a family practitioner, a medical doctor. Mom was a housewife with quite a background in opera. Apparently she could have made it big, and she opted more for the family situation. However, despite that, and despite the fact that Hemingway made a profession of faith as a teenager, was active in his youth group, was a youth group leader as a teenager, Hemingway utterly rejected Christianity and the whole experience later in life. How could that be? And then we have what we know to be Ernest Hemingway, and we say, bad guy. And we label and categorize and relegate. And the in-between is very crucial, because when you look inside at what went into making those rings of Hemingway's life, you have situations like a father who was a good man, and Hemingway deeply loved his dad, except his dad was sort of an authoritarian type. He was a sweat and nail sort of man, and that was his approach to Christianity. But he was not hypocritical, and that was what Hemingway loved about his father. He was deeply consistent in his life, and even as a practitioner, he would treat a Oak Park, Illinois banker on the same par as he would treat an Indian woman living in a shack who had no money. And if he had a patient who couldn't pay, he never expected pay. He was a very godly man. But his insides, his personality was such that he was a very rigid kind of man. Hemingway's one sister noted at one point that he was the kind of man who could be sitting with you on the couch and have you as the daughter sitting on his lap or next to him, and you could be laughing and having a fun time, and suddenly he'd remember there was something you did yesterday that wasn't quite settled and it was wrong. And he might turn you over his knee and spank you and send you to bed without supper. You'd have to always have to confess your sins to God after you had been spanked for having done wrong. And that moment of gladness, the fun, rich times with Dad, you did wrong, and you remember, and so it's shot, and you go to bed without supper. That's not a good way of parenting, I don't think. He was that kind of man, though. The mom, on the other hand, did more damage, apparently, to Ernest in particular, because even though she gave up the opera scene, she still had this culture mentality. She, while the dad was sweat and nails, the mom, Grace Hall Hemingway, was a woman who everything had to be sweet-smelling and perfume and beautiful. And she was the kind of woman who would never touch a dirty diaper, despised the sight, little and the smell of vomit or diarrhea. And if you've had children, you know. That's part of the package. And if you can't buy this stuff, you're in a lot of trouble. Which they were, because what happened is Dr. Hemingway ended up having to cover a lot of the bases for his wife. He did a lot of the changing of the diapers. He had to call home pretty much every day at 4 o'clock to remind Grace, time to put the food on if we're going to eat tonight. She converted one of the large front rooms into an operatic little stage area. She built a stage and a balcony, and it would invite people from the neighborhood to come in and listen to her perform her operatic numbers. Very unusual woman. Now, she was loving. She was a nice woman. But that balance, the sweat and nails guy as a dad, and everything is sweet-smelling and beautiful, that's not a grand combination. And over the years, there was an insidious, subtle shift to where the dad ended up kind of having a hybrid role. He was the mother and the father. And Ernest progressively developed a deep resentment toward his mother. Because I think overtly to his mother for doing that, and subtly to his dad for buying it. Because the dad shouldn't have bought into that. He became a journalist briefly at the Kansas City Star, and then was drafted, went overseas. And here's what we think of how powerful memories and experiences can be. He saw one of the worst battles in history, and he saw a campaign in Italy. He was a medic, an ambulance driver, and he saw, I think, in this one single battle, there were 320,000 Italians got killed. And watching that, seeing this, and then one bomb blew up near him, and the shrapnel, his legs, incredibly, they were pockmarked and riddled with shrapnel. And he came back to the United States because of that. Couldn't sleep at night without the light being on, without drinking some. Very scared. Had a hard time adjusting. Couldn't get a job. Couldn't stay motivated. And the longer that drug on, the more his parents became dissatisfied with him. He went, get a job, kid, you know, and work. Get your life together. And not accounting for the things, the kinds of traumas that war could do to a man or woman. And Hemingway eventually got to pursue the one thing that he loved, which was what? Writing. And you know his parents' response? Get a real job. They did not buy the fact that my son could be a great writer. They think of that. If you were a child, or you have children, if your child says, this is what I like to do, your parents says, that's disgusting. Or that's a crock. That's out. There's a sense of real rejection. Writing is part of me. And he was. There were plenty of to back up the fact that ever since childhood, he was a very imaginative, very creative child. But they didn't identify that. They didn't nurture that. They shut it down. He went to Paris, the literary center of the time, and he wrote. Sent his first book back. Because it wasn't a Christian book. And it talked about some things that they weren't comfortable with. And it wasn't an immoral book. Parents mailed it back to him. Another one. Parents mailed it back to the publisher. And then came the real demise, culminating in the father becoming, later on becoming extremely ill, very diabetic and quite bankrupt, hadn't handled his money very well at all. And he had taken a gun that his father, the man who had gone through Wheaton, had handed down in the family line. And he put the gun in his mouth and committed suicide. Many years later, on a birthday, Grace Hall Hemingway mailed a birthday cake to Ernest together with that gun. This was after Hemingway had been married 3 times on his 4th marriage and had become the Hemingway we know so well. And Hemingway said to his friends, I know why she sent me the gun. She wants me to do what my father did. So you end up with, near the end of his life, Hemingway said this. He said, "I live in a vacuum that is as lonely as a radio tube, where the batteries are dead and there's no current to plug into." And that's despair. I live in a vacuum that is as lonely as a radio tube, where the batteries are dead and no current to plug into. So we look at Hemingway as this man locked in despair who does these raunchy, rank things, and we say, that's bad. And we categorize and we set him off and we say, that's Ernest. And we don't think that maybe there's stuff where you peel back the bark and you look at the rings. That's why the life of Christ and the way that he demonstrated compassion and love is so radical and revolutionary, because most of us don't live like that. We take people at face value for the most part and we say, what a loudmouth, what a wimp, and we don't take into account these incredible things that could be there. That's why one of the better pieces for me in the scriptures is the account in John 8 of the woman caught in adultery. It always intrigues me, they never brought the man. In an utter state of chauvinism, they bring only the woman. And they say, listen, the Lord Moses says we've got to do her in. And what is his response? Those without sin. Interestingly, have you ever noticed that it says that beginning, there was a long silence, and then beginning with the older ones, they began to drop the stones. There's a little wisdom. They knew, listen, we're out to lunch. And the younger guys slowly the younger guys got the idea, and they all dropped their stones. And he turned to her, and what did he say? Where are your accusers now? And he said, neither do I condemn you. And he did not approve her actions because he held her accountable. He said, get on with your life, but don't do it anymore. He held her accountable, but he did not condemn her. That is rich compassion to me. And for me, that's taking into account more than just the obvious, an adulteress. See, it's not just that. We are so quick and so easy to do that to one another. And the situation with Joseph, I think he betrays and he exemplifies how people can be hurt but handled relatively well. Hemingway demonstrates in a more contemporary scene, I think, how someone can end up not handling it well, unlike Joseph, but there'd be real powerful reasons behind it, powerful reasons for that being the case. Let me mention just two extremes. When you think of yourself or people you know who have deep wounds, a lot of painful memories, two extremes to avoid in trying to broach someone like Ernest or Joseph or yourself or whoever. One extreme to avoid is, do not see everything as being the devil. Now, you and I both know the devil is alive and well, and we both know there's such a thing as demonic possession, but that is not a widespread phenomenon. There's not like, oh, you have a problem? It's got to be a demon. And there are some theologies today and some denominational groups that the moment you say, I got a problem, even if it's just a psychological problem, I'm having a problem with thinking right in this scenario, you're forced to your knees, 45 hands are on your head, and they want to say, jerk something out. It is possible that there could be a demonic influence there, and I would encourage you, reserve that for careful use. Prayer, fasting if necessary, mature believers. It can't be used haphazard. It does happen, but don't be too quick, because it is more the minority, by far, than the majority say, oh, you got a problem? You got wounds that won't heal? You're having a hard time making your Christian life, being victorious? It's got to be demonic. Please be careful not to do that. The other thing is, avoid the glib, pat answers. If someone says, I'm really hurting over something, and I've tried seriously, honestly, to deal with this thing, I've looked for answers, I've asked questions, etc., I've prayed for years, this thing won't die, I still battle. If you come back with something like, I really love you, and what you need is to be filled with the Spirit, maybe it's your faith that's lacking, you deserve to be slugged. At that point, you have not taken time to investigate the kind of background that might be there. Incredible battles that could be there, the real reasons, the weaknesses, the infirmities, not sinful issues necessarily, but weaknesses, infirmities that could be there. And there are powerful feelings of struggle. Because, and let me go into some examples now, as a spring from Hemingway and Joseph. What kinds of general situations could make these powerful things that could challenge our lives, to which being too quick to say it's demonic or being too quick to say here's a glib pat answer, do not adequately broach the subject on? Let me give you a few examples. One is, I have a friend in Oklahoma City who, when she was 5 or 6, had a grandmother, no, I'm sorry, it was an aunt, who for whatever reason, this woman, this friend of mine as a child, developed an incredible fear of feathers. She never figured out where they came from, but she was terrified of feathers. And you know what this aunt would do? Whenever Sharon would go to this house, if the aunt ever wanted control, there was one room where Sharon could do the least damage, she was the most controlled, and that was in the kitchen. And there were two doors into the kitchen, and that was all. And what the aunt would do is she'd take two feathers, she'd put Sharon in, and she'd put one feather in one doorway, one feather in the doorway. And Sharon was literally terrified of feathers, and she'd just sit in the kitchen as a child. Now that gets locked away, the same way Neil Diamond's Brooklyn Roads got locked away. It's in, but in a much more obviously powerful and painful way. Why did she do that to me? Why is she reinforcing? Why is she helping to build this fear that I have of feathers? And who knows what happens in the mind and the world of a child, as imaginative as they are, that at 4 and 5, she's terrified of feathers, and this aunt comes and says, let me feed that a bit for you. Another woman I know who, one of her only home, they have his sheets hanging out over the balcony. So all the camp knew John wet his bed again. Until he was 14. You've got to know how bad that was for John. The embarrassment, the shame, the humiliation. One of those ladies died last year. And he told me, see, when he got the news, he was in a group of some of these missionary families and so on, and they said, old Mrs. So-and-so died. Isn't that a shame? And John didn't say a word. He told me, he said, I was almost happy. And he was embarrassed. I mean, that was bad, because he is a solid Christian guy. But that memory, what those women did to him, it was the bedwetting plus other stuff, obviously, but that was a big factor. So when she died, John didn't care. To grieve for them, the years he spent at their home, heck no. He didn't grieve because of painful, damaged emotions from back then. I have one friend, another woman in Oklahoma City, who was in her late 40s, when she was 4 years old, living on a farmhouse in northern Oklahoma. She was going up the stairs to the second story, and her grandfather was coming down the stairs. And he stopped her, and he grabbed her, and he touched her inappropriately. One time, she got scared, she slapped him away, and she ran up the stairs. A single experience, and she never, never forgot it. She was divorced when her three daughters were in middle to lower high school age. She purposed never to marry. If she ever did again, she would at least never marry until the girls were grown and gone from the house. Just because that fear from what happened at age 4 with a single inappropriate touch of what a man might do to a young child. She knew that these facts about the high rate of incest and child abuse and so on being quite high among stepfather-daughter situations. So she intentionally deprived herself of the possibility of marriage just to avoid the risk of ever having her husband touch one of her three daughters. And she's been single for many years now. But that's been a prime motivator. Why? Because of a single going up the stairs experience. For me, that's the stuff that has to do with the infirmities and the weaknesses that Jesus said, I understand. But I'm not judging you or condemning you for. There are fears that, for example, she, this friend, plus others who would have of men. And we say, come on, get with it. Get over that fear. Relate socially. Be strong as a woman or as a man, as the case may be. And don't take into account. We say, be filled with the Spirit. Ask God to change you and get with it. You know, don't be afraid of men. And you don't take into account how powerful that was in her perception at age 4. And other people, a lot of folks I work with in the care of child abuse, I mean, what this touch on the staircase is nothing compared to, you know, years of different kinds of abuse that could happen. And what does that woman or that boy do? And how that translates into their life. I'll never trust another woman again in my life. I'll never trust another man. And we come back with these glib answers that we say, let's cast out a demon. That's why I'm saying be real careful on those two extremes, because there is this huge bracket of deep, powerful, painful areas that have to be taken into account in compassionately working with somebody. The kinds of results, I think, the evidences briefly that you see of having gone through things that make for these emotional wounds and so on. The evidences are these, real briefly, and I know this is inconclusive as a list, but some of the major ones. You end up with things like, in the person who was a victim, that person having a very deep, profound sense of unworthiness. I just don't rate. I am not good enough. There's a high sense of dissatisfaction with themselves. A sense of esteem, identity is quite depleted or shattered.
That's one of the major evidences. So if you can catch any kind of outline here, what I've said is that there are two kinds of examples, biblical, Joseph, more contemporary, Hemingway. The kinds of extremes to avoid would be being too quick on the demonic and too quick on the glib answers. Some general types of experiences could be the sense of having been abused, the fear of the feathers, you know, those kinds of things that people get hurt by and they remember. And the products of those kinds of experience are these things. One, the products or the evidences are this deep sense of unworthiness. The second is a perfectionistic complex. Everything's got to be done right. That is very important, I think, because at least if you do it neatly, if you keep things quite categorical and quite well-defined and everything in order, there's a sense of accomplishment. My life is okay. And when I think back, my life was thrown in disarray throughout my childhood. But at least for now, there's a strong sense of safety if everything is this way. The problem with that is if you ever fail, if you ever break your system, if you ever fail to keep your expectations or your standards, you're dead meat, because then you're going to whip yourself and the whole guilt complex comes into play. But that need or the drive for perfectionism, to have a sense of, if I can just be there, I'll be okay. When you've got it, when you reach the goals you set for yourself, you feel okay. But if you ever fail to reach your goals, you know you're going to pummel yourself. So that's a troublesome one, the perfectionistic complex. By the way, a tangent to that, which is very gruesome, is the way we transfer that to God. Is that we live with a God who is that perfectionistic ogre. And if I ever make a wrong move, God will break my legs for me. If I don't do it to myself, He will get me. And we live with a God. I have one friend that I worked with for a while, who grew up in Texas with her dad, a tough farmer, very brutal with the kids, bad situation. I asked her at one point what her concept of God was. Give me an image, a mental picture of God. And this was it. She said, He is a very large, sort of overbearing figure. You never get to see behind His back, but if you ever do, He always has one hand behind His back. If you ever get to peek behind there, there's always a big stick. And every once in a while, He brings out the stick, and you know you're in trouble. That's my picture of God. As it turns out, that's exactly who her father was. She translated her experience onto God. I mean, this transference is quite common. And so who my dad was or what that painful experience was to me, I transfer implications of it onto God. God expects me to be perfect, to be perfectionistic. And yet that verse in Hebrews 4 says, Jesus understands my weaknesses. That allows for imperfection. It doesn't say, let's be sloppy and lazy. All the scripture says, let's become more and more excellent. But it is a process of becoming. And God doesn't expect me to be perfectionistic or to be complete at this point. But that tendency in me will force me possibly to impose on God. Say, God expects me. If I don't do it right, God will get me. Thirdly, super sensitivity. Very sensitive. I mean, you walk through the office, and someone looks at you, and you say good morning, and they give you a grunt. And you go back to your desk, and right away, I mean, it's this consuming sense of, what did I do? Where did I say something? There's an extreme sensitivity to, what did I do? Where did I go wrong? Did I say something? Obviously, there's some reasonable questioning there, but people get consumed by it. There's an overbearing preoccupation with, did I do something wrong? And people can give me constructive criticism, a simple little criticism to say, Mike, you didn't do too well there, and I'm destroyed. My week is destroyed. Very sensitive, because I can't tolerate those kinds of reasonable things because of possible severe kinds of criticism and punishment and hurts as a child. And fourthly, fearfulness. Very, very fearful. And possibly one of the greatest of those would be the fear of failure. I heard one story of apparently a true story in regard to a car salesman, where these fellows are standing in those giant windows at the car places, and they're inside, and they're looking out, and the one salesman said to a friend visiting, he said, look at that guy. He's a wheel kicker. And he said, they are the bane of our existence. And the guy said, what do you mean a wheel kicker? He said, watch him. And this guy would move all over the parking lot, and he would thump the hood and kick the wheels, and he'd look around. He would never buy. He would never make it. He's looking for a car, but he'll never make a decision. And then he'd take up all kinds of hours of these guys, these salesmen's time. And that's who these salesmen call wheel kickers. They come in there, indecisive, very unsure, very lacking in confidence, and the salesmen hate them. They're the bane of their existence, the way they describe them. And people who are very fearful, they are very much like that. They are very indecisive. They live very defeated, indecisive lives because fears consume them, fears that have roots. I read a quote yesterday, in fact, where one person says, yeah, but isn't it true that by their fruits you shall know them? And the guy said, yes, but be complete. Also take time not just to look at their fruits, but also to understand their roots. And I buy that. I think that there's a biblical legitimizing of looking back to see what happened in the roots to make for why they produce these kinds of fruits in their lives. Don't just judge them on the fruits. So what to do about this? One is, one measure is a little preventative. If you haven't done it, you can still do it now. This is an example in the case of a parent-child, but it would translate into any peer situation. If you don't relate to your children this way, I would encourage you to. When you leave a friendship, when you project on the line for leaving a friendship, for leaving a job situation where there are relationships, when you project for when your children will leave home, what do you project for in regard to what you will be remembered for? What do you think of? What is it that they remember me for? For example, as a parent, will my children remember me for a very long index finger? You know, the kind's always wagging, you disgusting little sinner, what have you done? You did it again? Always this tough, angry side? Or will they remember me for a rich smile? Certainly there's discipline, but I smile much more than I'm disciplined. What will they remember you for? At the office, in the relationships, and I'll give you one classic example for me. In England, there's a well-known painter, Benjamin West. Here's the background to this, though. When West was 12 years old, his sister was 10. He was left in charge by his mother when she went to the shop, just watch out for Sally. Simple thing for a 12-year-old. She comes home, and Benjamin has gotten into her colored inks. And Benjamin has made a mess. You know, colored inks, Indian inks on the carpet, on the table. You're not talking about an impressive situation. And a mother comes home to find that. What's the typical response? When you're thinking lethal thoughts, right? Terminating life. And yet, fortunately, this woman had enough sense. There was no malice. Why is it that whenever we see people do things wrong, we somehow insidiously...